had given him static about the data he and his father had collected and interpreted. Mars had been genuinely flummoxed by it until he thought back on his days in academia and what the chair of his department had once told him about colleagues who were bound and determined to relate every new finding to their own area of expertise and that area only. "When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail," his chair had said. This wasn't a new turn of phrase, but the point was new to Mars. There were more than a few scientists who knew one little thing and then thought that knowledge was universally applicable to every other problem, to the point of excluding or discounting information from people whose specialty was that other problem. Mars didn't particularly have that problem. He was all too aware of everything he didn't know, which these days felt like everything that wasn't about the collapse of the flow. But he was increasingly aware of the number of scientists brandishing hammers, looking for the nail in his data and in his presentation. It was exhausting. More than once, Mars longed to throw up his hands. "Say fine, don't believe me or the data. Enjoy being the first turned to jerky when the collapse comes." But then he remembered that he had promised Greyland, the Emperor of the Interdependency, who had improbably and somewhat ridiculously also become his friend, that he would help her find a way to forestall the collapse of their entire civilization. And that meant not bellowing to a theater of recalcitrant exogeologists that the flow didn't care whether they believed it was collapsing or not, and answering for the innumerate time the same damn basic question he received every single time he gave his presentation. "No time at all," Mars said to the man who asked the question, a self-important bald fellow who Mars believed was no doubt the preeminent scientist in the entire interdependency on some very specific type of igneous rock. Mars motioned to the schematic that floated in the air above him, showing the systems of the interdependency and all the flow streams that stretched between them all, pointing specifically to the stream connecting Hub, the capital of the interdependency, and End, which, as it happened, was Mars's home, and which he wondered if he would ever see again. "As I said, the stream from End to Hub has already started to collapse. It's collapsing from End in the direction of Hub. One of the last ships to come from End was the one I was on, as it happens. There have been no new arrivals from End in weeks. There will be no more arrivals, as best as the data can predict."
"So End is sealed off?" another scientist asked.
"In one direction." Mars pointed to the other stream arcing between Hub and End. "In the other direction, the stream remains open for now. We can send ships to End. They just won't be coming back." Mars then pointed to another stream, connecting Hub to Terhatum. "We're pretty sure this, the flow stream between Hub and Terhatum, will be the next flow stream to collapse. We expect this to happen within the next few weeks. The Emperor has assigned research craft to monitor the flow shoal here, and we're sending specialized drones through the shoal to gauge the soundness of the stream."
"How do you do that?" another exogeologist asked.
"Well, it's complicated," Mars said. "The internal topography of the flow doesn't precisely correspond to the space-time we're familiar with. In fact, if we didn't wrap our own ships inside a little bubble of space-time before they entered the flow, they'd just cease to exist, at least in a way we understand as existing. I could explain it better, but I would need more time, and I have another presentation to give across Hubfall in 2.5 hours. This got a small laugh. "When the stream from Hub to Terhatum collapses, then Terhatum will be cut off, like End is," said the bald, probably expert in igneous rocks of some sort. "No," Mars said, and was sure he heard a groan. "End is named End, in part because there's only one stream in and one stream out, and both lead here to Hub." Mars pointed to where the Terhatum system was displayed in his floating image. "Terhatum is connected to Hub, but it's also connected to three other systems as well. Shirok, Melaka, and Paramaribo. So now, instead of going directly to Terhatum from Hub, the quickest route will be going to Melaka first, and then to Terhatum. That adds an additional 9 days to travel. But Terhatsum won't be isolated.
Not yet. Mars went to his display controls and pressed a button to start an animation. But the collapse of the stream from Hub to Terhatsum is just the first. Shortly after that one collapses, we begin to lose more. One by one, the streams dropped out of the display, marking fewer connections between planets. Within 3 years, some systems are already isolated. The animation ran some more. Within 10, all the flow streams are gone.
And we have no way to get from one system to the next without them? Someone asked after a moment.
Not without taking hundreds of years at least, Mars said. Our ship's engines are designed to move in-system at a small fraction of the speed of light. Even if we built ships to go faster, say 10% of the speed of light, there would still be decades between the closest systems.
Mars saw a hand go up.
And of course, as scientists, I don't have to remind you that going faster than the speed of light is a physical impossibility.
The hand went back down quickly.
And you're sure about this? The bald man said. Because I mentioned to my brother-in-law, who is a flow physicist, that we were meeting with you today. And he said, bluntly, that you were a crank and that you have somehow managed to scam the Emperor.
Mars smiled at this. He was used to this question, too.
Sir, I don't think you understand, he said.
I, and my father, whose work this is, would be delighted to be wrong.
We would be delighted for every other flow physicist to sit with the data, which we have provided to anyone who wants it, poke holes in it, and show definitively that we missed some pertinent bit of information that shows we've been reading the data wrong all this time. Isn't that the way science works? You present the hypothesis to your peers, you show them all your measurements and observations and data, and you ask them to make you a liar. The best case scenario, sir, is that my father and I are revealed as cranks and I go home to end in ignominy.
There's only one problem with this, which I've already covered. Mars motioned again toward end. It's already begun.
Consistent with our predictions and data. At this point, we're still arguing about it only because one stream has collapsed, and we can still make other excuses for why those ships that should have arrived at Hub by now haven't arrived. When the collapse of the Hub Terhatsum flow stream happens, within weeks, the time for debate about the status of the flow will be over. And when that happens, what we need to ask ourselves is what we will be prepared to do as scientists to help everyone else in the interdependency to survive.
You say as scientists, but the Emperor has been claiming she is having visions about what's coming,
complained an exogeologist.
Mars looked uncomfortable at this. I can't speak to those. I can speak to Emperor Greyland's commitment to continuing and increasing scientific research on this subject, which was started by her father, Ottavio VI.
But don't you think it's odd that she's engaged in this mystical nonsense? I don't think it helps her case at all.
Mars paused for a moment to consider his words. My colleagues, he said finally, I have just given you an hour-long presentation on a hypothesis whose data fit the observed behavior of the universe, which has been peer-reviewed, and which conforms to every accepted standard and stricture for scientific inquiry.
Yet I can tell already that something like less than half of you are more than half convinced by it. You're scientists. If I can't convince all of you with my data, then it's possible I'll do even less well with the general public.
He glanced around at the exogeologists who were silent. Now, I'm not going to tell you I understand our Emperor's claim of visions and revelation, Mars said. I certainly can't say I believe them exactly. But I believe in the Emperor. I believe that the Emperor is committed to helping all of her subjects prepare for what's coming. And if having a vision helps where the actual observable and verifiable science doesn't, then I'm open to visions. Given what's at stake, maybe you might be too.
Mars sensed the woman before he saw her. Or more accurately, he saw Nadal Wilt, his assistant/bodyguard, tense up as they walked to Mars's waiting car and stepped between him and someone who was clearly walking up on both of them. He looked up and saw the approaching woman, a bit older than he was, with an air of dishevelment,
carrying a sheaf of papers. The woman saw Wilt move and stopped a few meters out, hands up, guardingly.
"Did you tell the truth in there, Dr. Claremont?"
Marsh smiled. It had been a while since anyone had called him doctor.
"About the collapse of the flow?"
"Absolutely." "No, not about that," the woman said, and the annoyed, dismissive tone came through clearly.
"About being delighted to be proven wrong."
"Ah," thought Marsh. "Here we go." One persistent feature of giving these presentations on the flow collapse is one or two attendees who would want to corner him later to share their own, scientific theories, like how the flow was actually the ghost plane, or how the Emperor was actually turning off the flow stream at the behest of a heretofore never discovered intelligent alien species, which looked like a cross between a shark and a poodle. That one came with art. Marsh's strategy in those situations was to be polite, but to let Wilt shove him along to the next thing.
"Yes," he said politely. "In this case, I would be very happy to be proven wrong."
"Are you sure about that? Because I have to tell you, Dr. Claremont, I wasn't very pleased when you proved me wrong."
Marsh was confused by this comment for several seconds, until he wasn't. Then his mouth literally dropped open.
You're Hatid Roynald."
"Yes.
You told the Nohamapetans that the flow streams are shifting, not going away."
"Yes.
You were wrong about that."
"Yes, yes," Roynald said irritably. "Maybe I wouldn't have been wrong if your father had bothered to answer my correspondence to him on the subject, but he never did."
"He was told by the Emperor to keep his research to himself," Marsh said.
"I understand that's his excuse, yes. The Nohamapetans used your data to attempt a coup."
"Well, they didn't tell me that's what they had planned," Roynald said. "Any more than I imagine the Emperor told you she was using your data for that ridiculous vision scheme of hers."
Marsh looked back at the conference building they had just come from.
"How did you see today's presentation? You're not an exogeologist."
"I grabbed the name tag and snuck in,"
Roynald motioned to herself almost dismissively.
"I look like this. The other exogeologists aren't exactly fashion plates. I fit in."
"Lord Marsh, we should go," Wilt said, knowing when to move things along.
Marsh turned, allowing himself to be moved.
"You're not right, Dr. Claremont," Roynald said, stepping forward again and then stopping once more when Wilt gave her the take-a-hint glare but not walking away.
"What do you mean?"
Marsh asked. Roynald pointed to Marsh's briefcase, which held his tablet, display projector, and papers.
"Your work. It's not right. It's not wrong, not entirely, but it's not right, fully. It's incomplete."
"Incomplete."
Roynald nodded.
"That's right."
Marsh took a step toward Roynald, much to Wilt's consternation.
"My father's data predicted the collapse of the end flow stream to an extremely high level of confidence," he said. "I checked the math myself."
"Yes," Roynald said. "It's correct. And you'll be correct with the hub to Ter Hatum collapse too.
Look, I said you weren't wrong."
"But how is that incomplete?"
"That part isn't incomplete, but your theory is.
You and your father have been working on a general theory of flow collapse."
Roynald rattled the papers in her hand.
"This is the special theory."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that your father is accurately predicting when flow streams are collapsing, and you checked the math on that, but he missed that in the process the flow would open some streams too. You never checked that because he missed it."
Roynald held the papers out to Marsh, who stepped forward and took them.
"I got things wrong because I started out with a few bad assumptions that I didn't check," Roynald said as he read. She shrugged. "Having peer review would have helped, but I was being paid not to tell anyone else. It turns out my process was right. I was just plugging in the wrong initial conditions. When I got your data, I saw that your father and I were studying different aspects of the same problem. Related, but nearly independent. And I incorporated his findings into my process." She pointed to the papers. "And got this."
Marsh looked up from the papers and blinked mutely at Roynald.
"Right?"
Roynald said, and waved at the papers.
"It's all preliminary, of course. But still."
"Lord Marsh," Wilt said, more insistently this time.
Mars acknowledged his bodyguard, then turned back to Roinald and held up the papers. Can I keep these? I brought them for you. How can I reach you to talk about this more? My contact information is on the cover sheet. Is there a good time to call? Roinald smiled awkwardly.
There's not a bad time to call, Dr. Claremont. I'm between opportunities at the moment.
Mars frowned. Thought you were a professor.
Yes, well, Roinald said. It turns out when your work is used by traitors as the reason to undermine the interdependency and attempt to assassinate the Emperor, it makes going into work at an imperial university problematic.
It's not your fault they used your data like this. They didn't tell you what they had planned.
No, Roinald agreed. On the other hand, I didn't really ask either, did I?
She shrugged.
And anyway, I had a lot of free time to work on this. Not entirely sure how I'm going to eat after next week, but I suppose that's what the interdependency minimum benefit is for.
Mars looked up at this.
Really?
He said.
That last part was probably too much, wasn't it?
Sorry, I have a hard time knowing where the line is sometimes.
Mars smiled and handed the papers back to Roinald. Come on, I've got another one of these presentations across town, which I'm now late for. We can talk on the way there, and then we can talk after.
All right, Roinald took the papers.
You really don't mind being proven wrong.
I wasn't actually expecting that.
You said it, Dr. Roinald. I'm not wrong. I'm just not right.
Chapter 6. The flow stream from Hub to Terhatum collapsed. The collapse was ahead of schedule, but within the penumbra of the prediction cone that Mars Claremont had offered Emperor Greyland II. The last ship through the flow shoal from Hub to Terhatum was the House of Nohama Peaton Fiver, I'll Always Remember You Like a Child, which entered the flow stream 6 hours ahead of the collapse. The captain of the child had been cautioned prior to entering the flow stream that the Emperor's science advisor was predicting its collapse and further warned that the collapse was likely to spread from random points within the stream and not, as had happened with the collapse from end to hub, beginning at one end and moving forward like a wave to the other. Hub's traffic control suggested routing through Malacca and then to Terhatum. The captain of the child, Daris Moria, expressed to her executive officer, Lind Burotinol, her contempt for Greyland II, her science advisor, and Hub's traffic control, and ordered her ship into the shoal on schedule. The ship would not arrive at Terhatum on schedule, or at all. The child would, in fact, be lost to the interdependency forever. It would tumble out of the decaying flow stream at a point several thousand light years from any known human outpost. This is because the flow, while thought of as a river or road or another sort of linear bearer of transportation, was not actually remotely like any of those things, or remotely linear. Had the child been tossed out of the flow stream a second earlier, it would have been only a light year from the star Sirius A, itself a relative hop and skip from humanity's ancestral solar system. If it had been tossed out a second later, it would have found itself much closer to the Milky Way's galactic core. Where it would have found itself in any of these instances was away. Away from Hub, away from Terhatum, away from humanity, away from rescue, away from life. I'll Always Remember You Like a Child was a ship designed to be capable of maintaining the lives and safety of its crew for 5 years before things would inevitably decline into chaos and madness. But like most commercial fivers, the child was not in fact set up to sustain its crew for 5 years. In the child's case, it had been tasked with making short-haul cargo trips from Hub to Terhatum and back again, over and over, trips that took roughly 2 weeks each leg. There was no need to fit the ship for long-term crew survival. Until there was. Captain Moria appealed to her crew for calm and got it for 2 weeks. In another 2 weeks, Moria would be dead, and the crew, which understood all too well what had happened to the child, where it was and wasn't, and how little food and other resources it had on hand, would begin to fracture. In another month, half the crew would be dead, including most of the officers.
6 weeks after that, and the crew would be down to 30 in three non-cooperating groups, and ship systems would begin to fail. It would be another 277 days before the final surviving crew member, a cargo handler named Jane Brisfelt, would record a lengthy testimonial of the last extraordinarily depressing days of the child and her crew before he would then go to the security office, obtain a sidearm, retire to one of the crew lounges, put on one of his favorite comedies, and then shoot himself mid-laugh during his favorite part of the story. The testimonial, recorded on a tablet, would be unseen and unheard by any other living thing. The tablet itself, whose internal battery would drain within 2 years, would lose the ability to function 50 years later, even if it had been charged. The child itself would be a cold, powerless husk within 10 years. It would never be found by humans or any other intelligent creatures, if there were any. It would drift between the stars for 20 million years before being gravitationally snagged by a passing red dwarf star, which it would orbit for another 6 million years in a comet-like orbit before falling into the star and vaporizing into its constituent atoms. But this was all in the future. At the moment, the collapse of the flow stream between Hub and Ter Hatoum was confirmed by a simple procedure. A research drone attempted to fly into the flow shoal and was unable to. Where the shoal had been only moments before was nothing but conventional space-time and vacuum. Other ships sounded the area on the idea that the flow shoal might have moved or was moving, a thing that had rarely been seen, but which was theoretically possible. It was not moving. It was simply gone. It would take weeks or months for the news of the collapse of the Ter Hatoum stream to reach all of the systems of the interdependency, including Ter Hatoum itself, now nearly 1 month away from Hub. But within the Hub system, the effect was immediate. On the Hub stocks and commodities exchange, stocks plunged and commodity futures collapsed, and billions of marks worth of value vaporized almost instantly. A very few speculators, having shorted the market, momentarily found themselves almost ridiculously rich, until trading was halted entirely and gains and losses frozen. Several mercantile houses filed claims to the House of Aiello, which held the monopoly on insurance for losses incurred because of the now almost certainly confirmed collapse of the flow stream from end to hub. The claims were for lost ships, cargo and crew, and ran collectively into the billions of marks. The House of Aiello rejected nearly all of these claims, asserting, not entirely unreasonably, that the collapse of the flow streams constituted an act of God. Shops and markets across the entire hub system were swamped by panicked shoppers who came in first for essentials and then for anything that was left. Overwhelmed store owners and managers tried to assure their customers that the collapse of a single flow stream did not mean they were immediately doomed to starvation and despair. This did not go as well as they hoped. Police and security forces across the system shifted to high alert and prepared for rioting. The good news was that the panicking seemed largely contained to the shopping experience. The bad news was that no one believed that would stay true for very long. The Church of the Interdependency and other religions found their places of worship jammed as the faithful, the newly faithful, and the not actually at all faithful, but this is some weird shit and I'm hedging my bets, came in. And, depending on experience, prayed, meditated, or wondered what it was exactly they were supposed to do now that they were there. Priests, ministers, rabbis, imams, and other religious leaders were on one hand delighted to be useful in a moment of spiritual and existential crisis, and on the other hand well aware that this was the theological equivalent of shoppers making a panic run at the market, with their new parishioners grabbing at anything and hoping it would get them through. In Hubfall, the newly fervent who weren't at a church found themselves at the gates of Brighton, the local imperial residence. Everyone in the Hub system was aware of Greyland's visions for the future of the interdependency and her championing of Lord Mars Claremont, whose scientific findings had predicted the collapse of the End and Ter Hatoum streams. Whether they believed her visions were sincere, a ploy to gull the credulous, or a sign of mental instability, they now had reason to believe she was onto something. And so they came to Brighton, some to revere, some to pray, and some because even if they didn't want to go to a church, they wanted to be somewhere in this teleologically deeply unsettling moment. The Emperor, however, was not at Brighton. She was at Xi'an, the massive imperial habitat hovering over the planet of Hub and the city of Hubfall. She was in communion, some suggested, with her ancestor Raekella, the only other prophet emperor, planning her next move, her next announcement, to save her people and her empire. Which was not entirely wrong, as far as it went. Archbishop Corbain couldn't say she was entirely thrilled to receive her next visitor, but at this point there didn't seem much that she could do to refuse him. And so, into her offices at the Xi'an Cathedral Complex, walked Lord Taran Asan.
"Welcome, Lord Asan," Corbain said with what she hoped was enough politeness.
Asan did a small bow with his head and swiveled his head around, taking in Corbain's private office, which was immense and exquisitely appointed.
"This is impressive," he said.
"Thank you," Corbain said. "I am the head of my church."
Asan nodded. "Not a church that's big on humility."
"We were founded by a scion of a merchant family, who then became the emperor of an interstellar civilization. So, no, not really."
"Speaking of merchant scions who became emperors, I assume you heard the news that Greyland II is going to address Parliament."
"I'd heard," Corbain said.
"There's speculation that she will use the occasion to announce martial law. Seeing as how her pet scientist's prediction about the collapse of the Ter Hatum's flow stream panned out, and now people are in a panic."
"It's not a panic yet."
Asan tilted his head and smirked.
"Really?"
"Really," Corbain asserted. "People are shaken and afraid, yes. But they're not burning things."
"Yet."
"Hopefully not ever. Fires and closed habitats are never good things."
Asan motioned with his head out the window, where a crowd had gathered on the lawn of Xi'an Cathedral.
"Your business is doing well in this moment of crisis."
"You had a reason you want to see me, Lord Taran?"
"What will the church do if the emperor declares martial law?"
"Is that why you came to see me?"
"It's part of it," Asan said. "As a representative of the guilds on the executive committee, I've been fielding a number of concerned calls and correspondence from noble houses and guild representatives. I know my counterparts in Parliament have been doing the same with their own constituents, but your constituency isn't people, Archbishop. It's the church itself."
"You say that like we don't have parishioners, Lord Taran."
Asan motioned back toward the crowd. "More now."
"I'm saying I disagree with your assessment."
"As you will, but you still haven't answered my question."
"I haven't given it any thought," Corbain said. "I haven't given it any thought because this is literally the first I've heard of such a thing. I'm not inclined to give snap judgments on hypotheticals. I might as well ask you what you would do if Greyland announced she was abolishing breakfast."
"I'm pro-breakfast."
Corbain threw up her hands. "You're missing my point."
"I got your point," Asan assured her. "But I dare say you're missing mine. I'm not offering you a random hypothetical like outlawing a meal. The emperor addressed the church in her capacity as its leader and announced she was having visions, a thing unheard of in a millennium, and obliged you, as a church, to follow her lead."
He waved toward the crowd at the cathedral. "She played that one very well, I'd say. You have an influx of freaked-out people flooding your churches and cathedrals, and suddenly your institution, the thing you represent, Archbishop, has more power. But it's power you have on loan from the emperor, who set it up with her canard about visions."
"What are you suggesting?"
"I'm not suggesting it. I'm saying it out loud. She pulled a coup on you. On you, specifically, Archbishop, and used the collapse of two flow streams to shift the power of the church onto her. And she did it so well that apparently you haven't even noticed it yet. Unless you have, and are perfectly fine with it."
Corbain opened her mouth to address this, but Asan continued.
"And now the emperor wants to address Parliament, right after the Ter Hatum flow collapse, when people are scared and vulnerable and looking to be reassured and politically persuadable. Given all of that, does my question about the possibility of the emperor declaring martial law sound like a random hypothetical to you now?"
"No," Corbain said after a moment.
So, back to my question.
But neither does it sound probable to me, Corbain continued, ignoring Asan's interjection. I've worked with this Emperor for her entire reign so far. I knew her before she was Emperor. Greyland is many things, Lord Terran. Not all of them desirable in an Emperor, but power-hungry is not one of them.
And if you're wrong?
What if you're wrong? Now it was Corbain's turn to motion to the crowd outside. Your assessment of Greyland's coup of the Interdependent Church glosses over the fact that at no point, either before or after her address to the bishops, has she tried to exercise any control of the church. She's not the one in this office setting policies and practices and doctrine. I am. She's not the one assigning priests to churches. Bishop Karnak is. She's not administering our social services. Bishop Ornil is. For now.
For now?
He's thinking of resigning. A sudden crisis of faith, he said. But whoever will take his place, they won't be put there by the Emperor. Which is my point to you, Lord Terran. For a coup to occur, power has to shift. None has.
If you say so, Archbishop, Asan said. And now I think I have your answer. Thank you.
He nodded and left as abruptly as he'd entered, glancing around at the office again as he did.
Corbain stood there for a moment, wondering what in fact had just happened, and then sat down at her desk, disquieted. She buzzed for Ubezisi, her assistant. He was at the door in an instant.
Yes, Your Eminence? Set a meeting of my advisors for this evening, Corbain said. 7 o'clock. Tell the bishops to clear their schedules if necessary.
May I tell them what the meeting is for?
I need their advice on the Emperor.
Issi paused as if to ask for further guidance, but thought better of it.
Yes, Your Eminence. And Ubez?
Yes.
Schedule a dinner service and refreshments. It's going to be a long meeting.
And how did Archbishop Corbain take to your suggestion she's been played? Asked Jason Wu. She denied it, obviously, Asan said. But the point wasn't to get her to agree. The point was to plant the seed of doubt. She already had doubts, of course. Someone of her position doesn't just go along with a brand new Emperor spouting about prophecy. That's a threat to her personal power and influence. Jason grunted. The two of them were in Jason's office in the Guildhouse on Hubfall, all clean lines and executive power, as befitted Jason's position on the Wu board. The two of them had tumblers of whiskey in their hands, which Asan reflected was as much a cliché of executive power as the big office they now stood in.
When the time comes, I'm going to need her as an ally, Terran.
I know that, Jason.
Good, because that time looks like it's coming sooner than later.
Because of the collapse of the Terhatum flow stream.
Because that's only going to be the first.
Well, Jason amended, second.
But the other ones are going to happen, and we need to be prepared before too many of them collapse.
Prepared for your coup. Jason grimaced.
Don't say that word out loud, Terran, for fuck's sake.
Call it what it is, Jason. You and I both know it's necessary. It's why you maneuvered to put me on the executive committee in the first place, to make the case for it to the other members.
Jason glanced over. Word is that you're not all that popular on the committee. The word asshole gets attached to you a lot.
I'm just being me.
It's true you've always been an asshole. I say that with respect.
I know. There's no point in me pretending to be who I'm not. The people on the committee aren't stupid. They would see through that. So I'm an asshole, but I'm an asshole who has a point, and they can't deny the point as much as they might dislike me.
That's optimistic. It's working.
Let's hope so. Jason took a sip from his tumbler.
Nadashe Nohama Peten is still alive.
I heard. Jason glanced over to Terran.
Is she alive because you told Darren I was planning to have her killed?
No, Asan said scornfully.
She's alive because Darren's office is 3 doors down and the House of Wu is incredibly leaky with information.
I hinted to you I was planning something. And I told no one.
You know I talked to Darren, and Darren knows I talked to you. The difference is that Darren thinks I am his double agent, when in fact, I'm yours. And as your double agent, let me tell you, it's a good thing your attempt failed.
Nadashi Nohama Peaton is dangerous. Yes, she is, but she and her house can be your enemy, or they can be your ally. The House of Nohama Peaton is in disgrace right now, but it's still powerful.
It still has powerful friends. And for what you're about to try to do, you're going to need all the friends you can get.
I wish I could have seen the look on his face when you told him it wasn't you who told me about his plan to murder Nadashi, Darren Wu said a half hour later in his office. His office was slightly smaller than Jason's, but perhaps more richly appointed, and his whiskey was better.
Well, you know, Asan said. You know I talked to Jason, and Jason knows I talked to you. The difference is that Jason thinks I am his double agent, when in fact, I'm yours. And as your double agent, let me tell you that now it's time for you to be careful with the Nohama Petons.
Why?
As of right now, I have an understanding with Nadashi. She'll put in a positive word for me with her house through her lawyer. In return, I'll use our law enforcement and security contacts to make a mess of the evidence leading to her,
which you will necessarily have to try to pin on Ahmet.
So?
So Ahmet is known to have been the favorite child of the Countess, so shitting on his memory to spring the child the Countess undoubtedly knows killed her favorite might not be the winning play you think it is.
Darren frowned. I see your point.
I thought you might.
Do you have an alternative plan?
Asan smiled. It depends on how aggressive you'd like to be in your quest to be Emperor.
So, you are playing the two Wu cousins against each other, said Tinda Luantintu,
who was the chief of staff for the Countess Nohama Peaton. She said this in the imperial suite of the Rachelin, Hubfall's most exclusive and secure hotel. She said it there rather than in the offices of the House of Nohama Peaton because there was currently a cuckoo in that particular nest, a thing that would need to be addressed presently. The Rachelin was an exquisite address, the imperial suite was gorgeously laid out and appointed, and the whiskey, which Asan took care to sip very slowly, given how much alcohol was already in his system at the moment, was almost impossibly fine.
I'm not exactly playing them against each other, Asan said. I'm allowing them both to think they are using me to spy on the other while I decide which of them I ultimately want to back in their run for Emperor.
That could turn out poorly for you if they compare notes, Luantintu said.
For them to do that, they would have to stop loathing each other for longer than 15 seconds. My family is close to the Wus, just like it has been for generations. I'm of an age between Jason and Darren and grew up socializing with both here in Hubfall. No one outside of the family knows them better than I do. Neither of them is in much danger of having a sudden fit of affection for the other.
You find it useful to keep them at cross purposes.
You say that as if it was me doing it, Taren said.
My family has a saying, no one hates a Wu like a Wu. It's a miracle when anyone on their board of directors agrees on what to have for lunch, much less their actual business. I'm not putting Jason and Darren at cross purposes, but I'm not against using their cross purposes to my advantage either.
Luantintu nodded.
Which is why you're here, Lord Taren.
Yes. You have to know that no matter what, Greyland is on her way out. If she's actually having visions, she's not stable. If she's not, then she's playing a game in a moment of crisis that's partly of her own making. For the good of the interdependency, she has to go.
If you say so.
Ah, but it's not me saying so, Asan said. Or not just me, anyway. The other houses are nervous about these changes in the flow and what Greyland might use them as an excuse for in terms of their business and monopolies. The Parliament is convinced Greyland is about to institute martial law. Even the Church is unsure what to do with Greyland now that she's imitating Raykella. Changes are coming. That much is obvious. And I think everyone agrees that when the change comes, we need stability right at the top in the imperial seat.
The House of Nohama Peaton has already stood out once against the Emperor, Luantintu said.
It was not to our advantage.
Asan shook his head.
No. Forgive me, Minister Luantintu, but the House of Nohama Piton has not stood out against the Emperor. One of its members has. And while that member may have acted unwisely, it's also clear they had a legitimate complaint. The Imperial House had agreed that the next Emperor would marry a Nohama Piton. Then the Emperor backed out of the deal. She shouldn't have. It's an error that should be corrected. And can be corrected.
Luantintu raised her eyebrows at this.
That is, if the House of Nohama Piton is willing to make a deal with one or the other of the Wu cousins now currently aiming at the throne, and to back it up with their resources and the resources of their friends.
When?
Soon, I would think. The Emperor's scientist has given us a timetable.
And what do you get out of it?
Asked the third person in the room, reclining on the couch, who until this moment had been silent.
How do you mean, ma'am?
How I mean, Lord Terran, is that I am not stupid, said the Countess Nohama Piton. I know why Jason and Darren Wu are caught up in this. It's because a Wu must be Emperor, and they are foolish enough to want the job, even now, as things are apparently falling apart. And it's clear what you think our interest should be, since you are clearly hinting at a political union between our house and whichever Wu floats to the top of this enterprise. What I want to know is what your interest is. You are already the director of the House of Asan's business affairs. You are already on the executive committee. You are already a lord. You have all the power you will ever have. What else is it that you want?
Asan smiled. Not for me, he said, and then pulled out his tablet and opened up a photo. Two small children were there, smiling up at the photographer. Asan showed the photo to the Countess.
Charming, the Countess said. And relevant how?
Relevant because one of them will marry the child of the next Emperor.
An unknowable play of emotions crossed over the Countess's face as she processed his words.
That is ambitious of you, Lord Terran, to plan that far ahead, considering our civilization is coming to a sudden close.
Not all of it, just most of it. There's still End, which your son Grenny is attempting to gain control of, and which Nadashe sent a ship full of marines to in order to help him do so. It's the one place in the interdependency where humans will be able to survive in the long run. Your children plan to secure it and make the House of Nohama Piton the new Imperial House. Well, that didn't go as planned, so it's time to go back to Plan A, marry an Emperor.
I'll help you do it. And all you want is the throne.
Yes, eventually. You can have it first, which is what you want, ma'am.
Asan saw the Countess Nohama Piton look over at her chief of staff, who nodded almost imperceptibly. Then her eyes came back to him.
Tell us more, Lord Terran.
To begin, which Wu would you prefer, ma'am? Asan asked. Jason or Darren?
Chapter 7. Kiva Lagos was in the middle of receiving some perfectly serviceable oral when her tablet pinged. She glanced over and saw it was Bunton Solanodon, her executive assistant. Kiva considered not answering it because she was busy and because she had told Solanodon not to bother her unless the world was on fire. But then, because there was a possibility the world was on fire, and also because the oral was serviceable rather than full attention-requiring spectacular, she picked up the tablet and answered it, voice only. Is the fucking world on fire? She asked. From below, her partner looked up quizzically and gave Kiva a look that she interpreted as, should I hold up? Kiva gave a motion with her hand, signaling that the oral should continue. Kiva's partner got back to it.
It depends on whether you consider an Imperial summons a fire-bearing situation, ma'am,
Solanodon said.
What? Explain.
The Countess Nohamapitan has asked for and received a priority audience from the Emperor regarding the disposition of the local activities of the house businesses. Specifically, she is asking you be removed from your position. I assume the Emperor thought it only fair that you be allowed to offer your opinion on that, Lady Kiva.
When is this audience?
2 hours from now, ma'am.
Then I'm going to need a ride.
I've already arranged for a pickup at your apartments and a priority seat on the Xian shuttle. Since you explicitly have an Imperial summons, you will have priority seating and clearance. An Imperial escort will greet you when you arrive, and I've already filed the paperwork for expedited passage through security.
No firearms when I go. Got it.
Yes, that would be advisable, ma'am, Solanodon said.
Kiva was never sure if he ever really knew when she was being sarcastic or not, and assumed he just chose the straight man lifestyle as a defensive choice.
Will it just be the three of us?
The audience? I understand the Countess will be bringing her lawyer, Ms. Fundapelonen. You met with her the other day, you may recall.
We're acquainted, Kiva said.
Should I have one of our lawyers join you for the meeting?
I've got this, Kiva said. Just make sure my receipts file has been updated. I may need it.
Yes, ma'am.
When is the car picking me up?
It will be at your apartments in 15 minutes, unless you would like it to arrive sooner.
No, that works, Kiva said, disconnected and then refocused herself on the perfectly serviceable oral she was getting. You should probably check your messages, Kiva said to her partner after she came.
Why is that?
Asked Senia Fundapelonen.
You'll see. Kiva went to her bathroom to go stop smelling like sex.
You could have told me about this when you got the call,
Fundapelonen said when Kiva emerged from the bathroom, no longer having the whiff of being perfectly adequately serviced.
You were busy.
Fundapelonen waggled her tablet in her hand at Kiva.
This is slightly more important.
That's a matter of opinion, Kiva said. And anyway, you're not running any later because of it.
I have to order a cab to the shuttleport and then catch a shuttle.
Just come with me.
And you don't think that looks at all bad? You and I taking a car from your apartment together?
Kiva shrugged.
It's not like the Countess doesn't already know we're fucking.
Fundapelonen blinked at this.
What?
I assume she told you I like to fuck around, so you should get with me to see if I would say anything useful while we banged.
Is that what you really think is going on here?
Fundapelonen asked.
Isn't it?
Well, yes,
Fundapelonen admitted.
But you're not supposed to think it.
Just because I like to fuck doesn't mean I'm stupid, Kiva said.
If you knew this was a setup, then why did you...
Screw your brains out?
Yes.
Why wouldn't I?
Because it's totally insincere?
Kiva squinted at Fundapelonen.
Do you get out much?
Fundapelonen was flustered at this.
Apparently not.
It's just sex, for fuck's sake, Kiva said. I wasn't planning to fucking propose. You offered, you're cute enough.
Thanks,
Fundapelonen said dryly.
And I haven't gotten laid that much since Mars Claremont traded up to the Emperor. And it's not like I was going to say anything to you about my business.
You mean... our business.
Well, that's what today's meeting will be about anyway, Kiva said. My point is, it was a safe enough opportunity to get laid.
I don't know how to feel about that,
Fundapelonen said.
It's not like you didn't get anything out of it, Kiva pointed out.
Fundapelonen smiled at that.
True enough.
She paused.
This is the first time I've ever done something like this.
Had sex with someone because your client told you to.
Yes.
How was it for you?
Mostly okay.
Well, good, Kiva said, and patted Fundapelonen's shoulder. Because you're about to get fucked by me again. This time, in front of the Emperor.
The Countess Nohamapitan was definitely someone who wanted all the bells and whistles and shiny fucking spangles, so her audience with the Emperor was held in the formal receiving room. It was cavernous enough that you could probably land a shuttle in it, although Kiva supposed, given who was both asking for and giving this little farce of an audience, any snippy quips about a shuttlecraft would not be appreciated. Kiva glanced over at the Countess Nohamapitan and was not impressed.
The Countess, conspicuously ornate, had overdressed for this particular Empero. Graylanda had been overdressed exactly once in her life, at her coronation. And since that event had included a bombing and the murder of Greyland's best friend, it hadn't been exactly a sterling moment in fashion history. The Countess's advisors might have told her that Greyland preferred a more understated look. Either they hadn't, or the Countess had ignored them, and now she was looking like a grenade went off in a drawer of metallic ribbons. Kiva's own attire was rather more subtle, a formal suit of merchant black and gold with a pendant that showed off the colors of the House of Lagos, red, yellow, light, and dark blue. Kiva thought the formal suit made her look like a waiter or a fucking servant, but it wasn't up to her what to wear to see the Empero, so she just dealt with it. The Empero herself, as Kiva recalled, preferred a suit rather more like Kiva's than whatever sad monstrosity it was that the Countess was wearing, tailored exquisitely, because it would be, wouldn't it, and in the dark imperial green that shouldn't have looked good next to Greyland's skin tone, but managed to look just fine anyway. Being Empero meant everything looked good on you, maybe. A nice perk of an otherwise thankless fucking job. Kiva, the Countess, and Senia Fundipolonen, who was wearing the same nice conservative suit that Kiva had peeled her out of earlier in the day, all stood in front of the dais that held the throne Greyland would perch upon. Neither the dais nor the throne were particularly ridiculous, which meant they were out of place in the room, but in keeping with Greyland's own sensibility. From well behind the dais, a door opened, and Greyland entered the room. She did it without handlers, which Kiva understood to be increasingly her custom. She accepted bows and handshakes from Kiva and Fundipolonen, and a more elaborate curtsy bow, whatever the fuck it was, from the Countess. Then she stepped up the dais, sat herself into the throne, and smiled. "We are ready to hear you, our dear Countess Nohama Peten," she said. Kiva noted the use of the royal we, which was the first time she had personally heard that from Greyland. When she'd met her before, Greyland was all I and me. That said, the last time she'd seen Greyland, the Empero was getting over being attacked with spaceships. It was possible she was not entirely herself. The Countess did whatever that fucked up bow curtsy thing was again. "Let me begin, Your Majesty, by assuring you of the unending loyalty of the House of Nohama Peten. I am aware, we as a house are aware, that you have recently had ample reason to doubt the sincerity of this loyalty. I understand that the only way to regain that trust is to earn it again, slowly and with difficulty. It will be the mission of my house to do so, and in earnest of that mission, and as the first small step in recompense, I am pledging all Nohama Peten in-system profits this year to the Nafa Dolg Foundation." Kiva almost choked on her tongue at this bullshit. To begin, the Countess fucking well knew that she couldn't pledge those in-system revenues to anything. They were under Kiva's control, and she had the final word to how they could be used. Since Kiva had been in control of Nohama Peten's local businesses, all revenues had been placed into accounts that Kiva had made accessible to the Ministry of Revenue as a sort of permanent audit. The only way the Countess could do anything with the revenues without Kiva's consent was for the Empero to give back control of local operations, which was something the Countess undoubtedly knew as well as Kiva, so either this was the opening gambit to removing Kiva, or it was an attempt to make Kiva the asshole of the day, which would also be the opening gambit to removing Kiva. To continue, Nafa Dolg, the Empero's childhood best friend and first chief of staff, was fucking murdered on the Empero's coronation day by a bomb that was almost certainly but not yet provably planted by some asshole working for the Nohama Peten siblings, the asshole children of this asshole Countess. Whether the Countess herself knew about the attempt at the time or not, she certainly knew about it now, just like she knew the bomb was meant to kill Greyland.
So basically, the Countess Nohama Peten was currently saying to the Emperor, I'm proving my loyalty by offering money I don't have to the charity named for your friend who my kids accidentally slaughtered when they tried to fucking assassinate you. Which struck Kiva as an interesting way to try to win favor with the Emperor.
Either the Countess was laughably oblivious to the insult she was offering to Greyland, or she was daring the Emperor to make something of it.
Kiva, remembering both Nadashe and Granny Nohama Peten from her college days, doubted that the Countess was that oblivious. She might currently look like a glittered chicken, but she wasn't stupid. So this had to be a test of some sort or another. One that the Countess thought she was administering to the Emperor, to see if Greyland was oblivious, perhaps, or to see how the Emperor would react to what amounted to a bald-faced slap against her and her beloved friend. Or maybe the Countess just wanted to see what she could get away with and what the Emperor was willing to take from her. Or maybe she just thought Greyland was a fucking idiot. Kiva glanced over to Funda Polonin, whose face was pleasantly blank. Kiva wondered briefly whether her recent lover might have suggested this particular course of action to her Countess. She doubted it. Funda Polonin didn't seem to have the sufficient level of gut stabbery in her soul to pull a stunt like this. Kiva's eyes went back to Greyland, who took this all in and processed it. Go on, Kiva thought. Fucking ask me about this.
Your pledge moves us, Countess, Greyland said. It is a reflection of the quality of your soul, and we are glad to know it.
And then, after that absolute fucking masterpiece of saying, oh, I see you, bitch, and making it sound like a compliment, the Emperor turned her attention to Kiva.
We wonder what Lady Kiva, as the Countess's in-system director, has to say regarding this remarkable offer.
Watch this, Kiva thought, and began. No doubt the Countess has the best of intentions, Your Majesty. But I regret to say that this year, our in-system profits will be close to zero. Greyland blinked at this.
And why is that, Lady Kiva?
Widespread graft, ma'am. I instituted an audit when you asked me to supervise the in-system businesses of the Nohama Petens, and we have uncovered substantial business discrepancies, all of which will affect revenues and profits. We are still uncovering them. It will take months to get a full account. And meanwhile, we are in a position of having to deal with make goods with our customers, as well as fines and penalties, which will be assessed by your own Ministry of Revenue.
This is unhappy news, Greyland said.
I can have a full report sent to you if you would like, Kiva said helpfully. It has already been sent to the Ministry of Revenue.
Thank you, Lady Kiva. We would like that very much.
And if I may, Kiva continued, I can offer you a solution to this unfortunate problem.
We are listening.
No doubt the Countess had no intention of offering you nothing when she offered you this year's in-system profits, Your Majesty. Her own accountants were misled and deceived, and as she has newly arrived in-system, I have not had an opportunity to get her or her people up to speed on the financial affairs of the local business. This is almost certainly an innocent mistake. And truth be told, if the graft were not as endemic and widespread as it is, the House of Nohama Peten would be having a banner year profit-wise.
What do you suggest, Lady Kiva?
Greyland asked. Simple, Your Majesty. I will have my accountants provide you a sum that represents the sum of local profits for the last 12 months without the graft and penalties. The Countess may then present to the Nafa Dolg Foundation a donation of that sum from the House of Nohama Peten General Coffers. Everyone wins.
Greyland nodded and turned back to the Countess Nohama Peten.
If the Countess will accept this small emendation to her generous offer, as we are sure she will, then we will be delighted to accept her gracious gesture.
Suck on that, you duplicitous crab, Kiva thought.
The Countess thought she was testing Greyland, and it turned out she was the one who got schooled. The Emperor had turned her slap of a gift around and shoved her face right into it. The Countess Nohama Peten allowed herself roughly a second and a half to blink in surprise, and then,
"Of course, Your Majesty. It will be exactly so. Wonderful."
Greyland turned to Kiva.
When may we expect that number?
I can have it to you tomorrow, Your Majesty.
We will expect it then.
Over to the Countess again.
And the Nafadolg Foundation may expect your contribution quickly after, within the week?